Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
The truth is the most convincing story that maps onto reality, and that's why the central narrative is falling apart.
Right now in the United States, people should not be walking around with masks.
We must see the central narrative for the fiction that it is. We are Americans.
While elections are sometimes messy, this was a secure election.
The founders began the fight for human liberty and self-governance, and it's up to us to finish the job.
I tell you what, we are in a truth emergency right now.
This is the end game.
It's Wednesday, March 20th, 2024, the 1155th day of dystopia. I'm your moderator, Chris Paul. Let's be reasonable. A warm welcome and hello to all of you listening to the podcast on the day of its release. The only way to do that is by becoming a paid subscriber at imyourmoderator.substack.com. You can do so for as little as $50 a year or $5 a month, and in doing so, you will be supporting me, the work I do, and this show as it expands. And if you can't or you simply don't want to, continue listening to the podcast for free a couple days later on a wide variety of podcast platforms and, of course, Rumble. All I ask is that you share it with your friends. You can find the links to the podcast, the writing, the social media, and the merch site by visiting linktree.com/imyourmoderator. So let's just get right into it. Last night, we had another round of fake primary elections all across the country. We had Arizona. We had Illinois. We had Kansas. We had Ohio. And we had Florida, where Donald Trump won. Now, I was told throughout 2023 that there was no way Donald Trump was going to win Florida. That was Ron DeSantis' state, and Ron DeSantis is America's governor. And he is so popular in Florida that he's even more popular than Donald Trump. And of course, everybody knows that if you're America's governor and you're more popular than Donald Trump in Florida, you're also that way throughout the rest of the country. That's what we were told. Didn't happen that way, of course. Ron DeSantis dropped out a long time ago. Donald Trump cruised to 5 victories in 5 fake primary contests, as did Joe Biden, crushing his competition with a little bit of help from the Democrat Party, who basically just canceled their primaries everywhere. And I want to take just a couple of things from this Guardian article covering the primary elections, U.S. primary elections. Biden and Trump notch wins in 5 states. They put it this way. Donald Trump also won the Republican primary in Florida, where the Democrats are not holding a primary. Weird, huh? They went on. In Ohio, Illinois, and Florida, the former South Carolina governor and presidential candidate Nikki Haley still captured a sizable fraction of the Republican vote, despite no longer being in the race. Somehow, Nikki Haley is still racking up all these votes. She received over 100,000 votes in some of these primaries last night. Where are those votes coming from? It's like they were already loaded into the system or something and are still appearing even though Nikki Haley has dropped out. And of course, Joe Biden, he doesn't really have any opponents anymore. They're canceling some of the primaries altogether. But still, Dean Phillips, he dropped out. Marianne Williamson unsuspended her campaign. Now she's getting a bunch of the votes, all of Dean Phillips's votes. And of course, there are still protest votes out there for, hey, Joe Biden, stop supporting Israel's genocide. According to The Guardian, Democrats seeking to register frustration with Biden over his handling of the war in Gaza are urging supporters to vote for the self-help guru Marianne Williamson in Arizona, as she, unlike Biden, has called for a permanent ceasefire. Pro-Palestinian protesters in Ohio, meanwhile, are urging supporters to leave it blank. And apparently The Guardian is not great on understanding things like time. If you have already announced the winners of these elections, it does not make sense to talk in a future tense about what might happen. These might be the results, and if they are, here's how to understand them. The Trump-supported candidate Bernie Moreno won his primary in Ohio, defeating Matt Dolan, whose family owns the Cleveland Indians and changed their name to the Guardians, and Frank LaRose, who is a through-and-through rhino. The news outlets, for some reason, have also focused in on a win by Illinois Chicago Congressman Danny Davis, who's an 82-year-old Democrat. He apparently had stiff competition from some younger women, but was able to beat them in Chicago with support from Governor J.B. Pritzker and the Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson. So the country's most corrupt Democratic hellhole has somehow won another primary for an 82-year-old Democrat. It's kind of like how Nancy Pelosi always wins so easily in San Francisco and Maxine Waters in Los Angeles and that weird Al Green character in Houston. It's amazing how these old school incumbents just never seem to lose. They are just beloved by their communities. And it's amazing, too, the communities fall apart and these Democrat representatives, they just keep on going strong. The only solution is more Maxine Waters. The Tampa Bay Times has this interesting note about Florida's result. They write, Trump's support was slightly weaker among Floridians who voted early and by mail, with DeSantis and Haley combining for more than a quarter of those votes in some parts of the state. So Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis did better with early voting and with mail-in ballots. Gosh, what a stunning revelation that is. I wonder if we might hear again in the future about how everybody knows Donald Trump does worse with early voting and mail-in balloting. And so what we have to do to fix that is convince all Republicans and all Donald Trump voters to participate in those fraud-riddled activities. I mean, I guess if you can't beat them in a rigged system, you might as well join them in a rigged system. In fact, help strengthen that rigged system so it can always be rigged. And maybe they'll even give you a little power, huh, buddy? We've found the solution. Let's focus our hardest on those fraud-riddled activities where Donald Trump doesn't perform as well. We're scared of machine fraud on election day, so let's go ahead and use the machines earlier and give them our ballots and our votes and our data for a much longer time so that they can manipulate it. That'll fix the problem. The machines won't be what beats us, even if we have to give them another 7 easier ways to beat us. Or we could just make sure that our elections are actually made legitimate before we agree to go participate in them. The neocons over at the National Review got excited by Danny Davis's win in Illinois. Their headline today, longtime Illinois congressman defeats anti-Israel challenger in Democratic primary. See, that's a statement that's pro-Israel from these communist Democrats in the corrupt Democrat stronghold of Chicago. The National Review has figured out the proper analysis. Representative Danny Davis, who has held Illinois' 7th congressional seat since his first victory in 1996, defeated a crowded field of challengers Tuesday night in the Democratic Party's primary election. One of his challengers, community organizer Keena Collins, found herself on the receiving end of negative advertising from the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, that's AIPAC, independent expenditure arm of United Democracy Project. Collins, who tonight lost her third bid against Davis after falling short in 2020 and 2022, has criticized the incumbent for not signing a bill sponsored by Representative Cori Bush, calling for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. In an interview with Chicago's NPR affiliate, Collins characterized Davis's absence from the list of signatories as a complete slap in the face to the Arab American community in our district. She called for conditions on aid to Israel even before the ongoing war and described Israel's military response to October 7th as a genocide days after the Hamas attack. Now, you got to admit, it's been 5.5 months since the paragliding go-kart incident. Who are they still bombing at this point? But let's forget about that. I'm sure the whole thing is totally justified. It's strange, isn't it, that the same left-wing activist who is totally squad-aligned cannot win a primary as a Democrat for the last 3 cycles over an 82-year-old man. We're told that the Democratic Party represents the youth and young voters, and especially young women. And here we have a younger woman going up against an old, entrenched man who's been there for 28 years, and he just keeps dominating his primaries? We're told that there are entire movements of Democrats who go out to vote just to send a message to Joe Biden, wanting a ceasefire to what they call Israel's genocide. And the young voters who sustain the Democrat Party don't align with the young woman pushing that point of view? Strange, huh? I mean, even with these pro-Israel activist organizations getting involved with negative ad campaigns, is that really creating the difference? Does anyone actually believe that? Now, call me a conspiracy theorist, but just consider an entrenched Democrat who's been there for 28 years. They know they're going to give him the win in the primary. He's staying in office. That's already been decided. Nothing could be more obvious. And so what they need to do is create a justification for that. Well, what's the justification going to be? His opponent is mean to Israel. And even though her party likes that position, what they're going to do is run negative ads against her so that there is a story they can tell about why she lost to this old entrenched Democrat that doesn't include the fact that all these elections are stolen. Well, what'll it be? It'll be the Israel thing. They'll run some negative ads, say she's mean to Israel, and then people will believe, oh, it's because she was mean to Israel that she lost her primary, even though in all of these states they have, they tell us, 100,000 voters coming out just to express their disappointment in the fake President Joe Biden for his response to the Israel-Gaza situation. But wait a second here, the National Review, it gets a little confusing. Despite UDP's spending against Collins in this particular primary, incumbent Davis has by no means been a stalwart supporter of Israel during his time in office. Though he didn't go as far as to describe Israel's military response to October 7th as a genocide. So he refrained from calling it a genocide. That means that he is the pro-Israel candidate compared to Keena Collins, who does call it a genocide. And so the Israel activist organizations, they got involved and they are who created this big win for Danny Davis. He got 52% of the vote in a crowded field. And it's because of this Israel thing. After the 2014 Gaza War, which began when Hamas-affiliated Palestinians kidnapped and murdered 3 Israeli teenagers in the West Bank, Israel arrested nearly every known Hamas associate in the area, and the terrorist organization responded with over 4,000 rockets. Davis called on Israel to end the blockade of Gaza. In May 2023, he co-sponsored a resolution introduced by Representative Betty McCollum and signed by figures such as AOC, Ilhan Omar, and Rashida Tlaib that accused Israel of occupation in the West Bank and sought to place conditions on United States aid. Days after October 7th, Davis issued a statement in which he professed his support for Israel's right to defend itself and to seek a safe and secure environment in which to live and work, and advocated a safe return for hostages held in Gaza, but also urged Israel to let people in Gaza have access to water, energy, food, medical supplies, and medical personnel. About a month later, he reportedly called for a temporary ceasefire, saying there needs to be a pause, if not a cessation, to let aid and medical supplies and food get to these individuals in the Gaza Strip. So once again, that was pro-Israel enough for the pro-Israel lobbies and activists. And because apparently Danny Davis's district, who has kept him in office for 28 years, made their decisions this year on his Israel viewpoints. Collins acknowledged the AIPAC-associated UDP's involvement in the race in a post on X, claiming the organization targeted her, quote, because they know we have the momentum to win, and said AIPAC has, quote, given donations to over 200 GOP members of Congress who supported the insurrection, a talking point that has become common among progressive politicians. They also happen to be right. The insurrection bit, of course, is nonsense, but it's not like AIPAC is a supporter of diehard progressives, and that's the point she's making. So the district, which is progressive enough to keep Danny Davis there for 28 years, is also pro-Israel enough to keep this ancient man in Congress for another 2 years based on the fact that he's not quite as far left as Keena Collins. Got it. In response to a National Review request for comment, UDP sent a written statement, also posted on the organization's X account. This was a significant defeat for the squad and the anti-Israel fringe, as one of their star recruits lost her bid for Congress. The statement reads, notably, Keena Collins is yet another Justice Democrats candidate who ran against a progressive black incumbent member of Congress. And that's amazing. According to the pro-Israel organization, it is mean and bad for Keena Collins, a prospective member of the squad, one of the Justice Democrats, to have challenged a black incumbent. It's like racist or something, I guess. Except the thing is that Keena Collins is also black. It's continually funny to watch them attempt to explain the unexplainable. They're like, people will believe this. We say the Israel thing. They're like, oh, yeah, Israel's really important to everybody. They'll believe that's what everyone's voting for. You know, those progressive districts, they just can't elect anyone if that person doesn't immediately want to go to war all the time. Just proxy wars, Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, anywhere. You can't get progressive votes, liberal votes, unless you're willing to go to war all the time with anyone. Apparently, that's where we are now. Makes sense? No, it doesn't make sense. All right, so let's move from fake primary elections to fake indictments. There's all sorts of Trump legal news this week. On Monday, we heard about how Donald Trump wasn't going to be able to afford to pay his bond in the Arthur Engoron civil fraud lawsuit in order to appeal the terrible decision demanding Donald Trump pay over $500 million for a non-crime with no victims about real estate valuations that were made as estimates and included a disclaimer clause and statement attesting to the fact that these were just rough estimates and that the banks would have to do their own assessments. The entire case is preposterous. This is the Financial Times covering it today. New York Attorney General rejects Donald Trump's pleas for leniency over $464 million bond. The New York Attorney General has rejected Donald Trump's claim that it was a practical impossibility to post a bond while he appeals against a nearly $500 million fraud judgment, escalating the threat that the state will move to seize his assets as soon as next week. In a court filing on Wednesday, Dennis Phan, a lawyer for the Attorney General's office, argued that the former president could piece together a series of smaller bonds or use his real estate portfolio to secure bank credit that could then back a surety bond. Quoting the Fan response, defendant's argument that obtaining a full bond is purportedly impossible is based on the false premise that they must obtain a single bond from a single surety for the entire judgment amount of $464 million. So, you get it? He can go out and get a bunch of little bonds that add up to the right amount. That is totally possible in the mind of someone who actually doesn't know. The clock is running down on a 30-day grace period that Letitia James, the attorney general, offered Trump after a New York judge last month ordered him to pay $464 million, including interest, for fraudulently inflating the value of his properties by billions of dollars over several years. And of course, this is the problem with the fake news. They take these claims as true because a judge said they were true. And even though there will be an appeals process in the future that will hopefully do justice based on the actual facts of this case, rather than just weaponize the legal system against a political opponent, we have reached the Banana Republic phase. In what would be an extraordinary confrontation in the midst of a U.S. presidential campaign, James, a Democrat, has threatened to seize Trump's assets if he does not comply by Monday, which would deal a blow to the real estate empire upon which his fortune and brand name have been built. Trump's lawyers have asked an appeals court to delay enforcement of the judgment. So, Letitia James, a woman who ran on getting Trump and brought this case, this ridiculous civil fraud case, has been keeping a running estimation of how much Donald Trump owes her as interest accrues by the day. She is supposedly using her position of public trust and her taxpayer salary to put out tweets tracking how much more Donald Trump owes her for this political witch hunt. Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee for president in the November election, issued a fundraising email to his supporters on Wednesday with the headline, "Hands Off Trump Tower." A surety bond serves as a letter of credit to ensure that a defendant will pay a judgment if they lose the case on appeal. To protect themselves, underwriters will often ask for collateral that exceeds the amount of the judgment itself. They also charge an upfront fee of 1-3%. Trump's lawyers told the court in a filing on Monday they had approached 30 large insurers, but that none was willing to underwrite the bond. The problem, according to Alan Garten, general counsel for the Trump Organization, is that the insurers refused to accept real estate as collateral, instead demanding cash or liquid securities. Posting the bond would be a practical impossibility, Trump's team told the court. The state of the privately held Trump Organization's finances is opaque. In a deposition last year, Trump said he had substantially in excess of $400 million in cash. He has since posted a $92 million surety bond for a separate legal judgment after he was found to have defamed the writer E. Jean Carroll. That bond was underwritten by Chubb. Gary Giulietti, an insurance broker for Trump, estimated his client would need to scrape together $557 million in cash equivalents and pay a fee of $18.5 million to cover a $464 million surety bond. So that is now $575.5 million. That is what one creepy little pervert of a fake judge decided Donald Trump owes in this fake indictment by Peekaboo James. Do we have to see actual Trump assets taken away by these communists so that we have a visual representation of just how far they'll go? Maybe we do. Maybe we need to see one of Trump's buildings taken away from him. Now, I don't think that's going to mean that Trump never owns that building ever again. But you can imagine the visual impact of all that. It would be a brilliant, visual, widespread, viral media event. Letitia James seizes 40 Wall Street. Letitia James seizes Bedminster. It would be nice if we didn't have to actually see these things, if people could just get it. But apparently they can't, so we might have to see it. And the worst part is that he has to do this so that he can appeal, so that he can use the legal system. He is being treated unfairly specifically because of who he is. And it's funny because even Ruth Bader Ginsburg has confirmed this at the Supreme Court. She wrote, "The Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause is an incorporated protection applicable to the states under the 14th Amendment's due process clause." This is from Timms v. Indiana in 2019. The Los Angeles Daily News covered this on February 24th. Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Trump's $355 million fine, writing, "This was a civil fraud trial without a jury, in which the judge found Trump guilty of giving his assets a too high valuation to get good loan terms, even though the bank adjusted those values downward before approving a loan that was paid back fully and on time with interest. For good reason, the protection against excessive fines has been a constant shield throughout Anglo-American history. Exorbitant tolls undermine other constitutional liberties," wrote Ginsburg. "Excessive fines can be used, for example, to retaliate against or chill the speech of political enemies." New York Attorney General Letitia James campaigned on a promise to sue Donald Trump, calling him an illegitimate president. She said she'll ask the court to seize Trump's buildings if he can't come up with hundreds of millions of dollars in cash in time to pay the fine. So even the liberal feminist icon Ruth Bader Ginsburg has an opinion that would invalidate what the communists are attempting to do to Donald Trump in this particular Get Trump case. Let's finish up with the Financial Times. One bond broker who asked not to be identified believed that was feasible, but that insurers had misgivings about dealing with the polarizing former president. "It's a political hot potato. No one really wants to get involved with this," the person said. I wonder where the pressure is coming from. Meanwhile, going through a bank would be costly for Trump. A letter of credit from a lender backed by real estate would carry a separate fee in addition to the premium for a surety bond. Many lenders have long been wary of doing business with Trump based on his record of bankruptcies and his reputation for not paying bills. That's just not true, and the banks testified to that in this case. They may be more wary after the New York court's ruling in the fraud case found that he had lied about the value of his assets. Well, that is also false. No business would take this court's opinion that will later be reversed on appeal as a justification for why they wouldn't do business with Donald Trump, knowing that they will make a profit doing business with Donald Trump. It doesn't make any sense. "This is a pain game," the broker said. "How painful is this going to be for him to do it?" And of course, that's the whole point. The whole point is to embarrass Donald Trump, impoverish Donald Trump, imprison Donald Trump, prevent Donald Trump from winning an election, and by that I mean winning a narrative battle about an election that he has already won. They need to give the country a justification for believing that there is some possibility out there in the world that Donald Trump won't win. They need to get to that point by November 5th, assuming that they hold a fake election. They would need to be able to convince the country that Joe Biden really won somehow, if they intend to steal it on behalf of Joe Biden. If they can't do that, they will try to steal all the down ballot races, give Donald Trump nothing to work with, and attempt to subvert his presidency the way they did in the first term. Now let's go back to one of those quotes from Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She wrote, "Excessive fines can be used, for example, to retaliate or chill the speech of political enemies." That is exactly what is happening here. The excessive fine is a violation of the Eighth Amendment that also constitutes a violation of the First Amendment. Here is the text of the Eighth Amendment, by the way. "Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted." They are trying to make Donald Trump come up with nearly $600 million in cash in order to appeal. His rights are being violated, and he cannot contest that violation of the rights unless he comes up with $600 million. After already coming up with $90 million to do the same thing for the fake E. Jean Carroll issue. Now, last week, Mike Lindell created a lot of hype taking his case to the Supreme Court. Kurt Olson is the attorney in the filing representing Carrie Lake and Mark Fincham. They are still contesting the 2022 midterm elections that were absolutely rife with fraud in Arizona, and they are going after the machines. And one of the elements of that case deals with a very similar form of the deprivation of First Amendment rights, writing, "For candidates, Maricopa's elections inflict not only unequal footing injuries that deny the right to run for public office under lawful and reliable competitive elections, but also by increasing public distrust in elections." Citing the Seventh Circuit in 2000, Krislov versus Rednauer, "Voter fraud drives honest citizens out of the democratic process and breeds distrust of our government. Make it more difficult and more expensive for candidates to get voters to vote, forcing candidates to spend more time fundraising and less time campaigning, thereby inflicting First Amendment associational injuries." It goes on, "Being required to allocate additional campaign resources in itself can be an injury to First Amendment rights, beyond the financial and unequal footing injuries." So Donald Trump would also have that route. The fact that they are waging lawfare against his campaign and making it impossible for him to campaign, he's wasting all of these resources on the legal effort rather than on his campaigning, that is a violation of Donald Trump's First Amendment rights, in addition to all these other violations of Donald Trump's constitutionally protected rights. And I believe a big aspect of kind of the macro picture here is that each and every one of those rights enumerated in our Bill of Rights is going to be challenged by this illegitimate, authoritarian, communist regime. Which of our constitutionally guaranteed rights in the Bill of Rights has not been violated? We are being shown why all of them are necessary. One last note before we move on. The DWAC TMTG merger is Friday. At that point, assuming everything goes as planned, Donald Trump's stake is reportedly going to be worth about $4 billion. So all the reports of Donald Trump going broke are a bit ridiculous. In addition to that, CNN reported yesterday Republican billionaires rally around Trump for an April fundraiser as election and scramble for cash heats up. And so this is about a hedge fund founder named John Paulson recruiting all of these other high dollar Republican donors together for an event in April in Palm Beach that will supposedly flood Donald Trump's coffers with cash. CNN writes, "Co-chairs of the inaugural leadership dinner in Palm Beach include hedge fund billionaire Robert Mercer and his daughter Rebecca, oil tycoon Harold Hamm, hotelier and space entrepreneur Robert Bigelow, and casino mogul Steve Wynn. Bigelow had earlier backed Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in his political ambitions before committing to supporting Trump earlier this year. The Mercers had been big Republican donors and major backers of Trump's 2016 campaign before taking a lower profile in politics during the 2020 cycle. And all of that was very weird, especially with the whole Parler debacle when that got taken down. The Mercers were founding investors of that project. Other co-chairs on the invite include Todd Ricketts, whose family owns the Chicago Cubs and helped lead Republican National Committee fundraising efforts during Trump's White House tenure, and longtime Trump allies, such as New York Jets co-owner Robert Wood Johnson, who served as U.S. ambassador to the U.K. under Donald Trump, and Wilbur Ross, who was Trump's commerce secretary. There's also kind of this groundswell movement among Trump supporters, I don't know how serious it's going to get, saying that if all of Donald Trump's voters threw in about $7 for him, he would have enough money to cover this bond for the appeal. I really doubt it will get to that point. And if it starts looking like Letitia James is going to take one of his buildings, then that's what the story was always going to be. And because Donald Trump is always on offense, there was this on Monday as well. This is the New York Times. Trump sues ABC and Stephanopoulos, saying they defamed him. Former President Donald J. Trump filed a defamation lawsuit against ABC News on Monday, arguing that the anchor, George Stephanopoulos, had harmed his reputation by saying multiple times on air that Trump had been found liable for raping the writer E. Jean Carroll. A jury in a Manhattan civil case last year found Mr. Trump liable for sexually abusing and defaming Ms. Carroll, but did not find the former president liable for rape. The judge, however, later clarified that because of New York's narrow legal definition of rape, the jury's finding did not mean that Ms. Carroll failed to prove that Mr. Trump raped her, as many people commonly understand the word rape. And so immediately we have to fall under the spell, this communist spell of the constant appeal to authority, because some judge handed down a decision that said a civil fraud jury that wasn't asked to actually assess the facts, and Donald Trump was not, by the way, allowed to defend himself in this case, thought that it was at least 50% likely that E. Jean Carroll was telling the truth, despite having no idea when this supposed rape happened. And she wouldn't list a time, because then, of course, a busy man like Donald Trump, whose moves are all recorded, would be able to say, actually, no, I was not at Bergdorf Goodman's with this crazy lady that day. But because there is some source that says something like the thing they want to say, well, then it's okay to go around saying that Donald Trump was found liable for raping this woman. And they pretend that that constitutes some sort of factual finding of guilt when it doesn't constitute that at all. Donald Trump could never be found guilty of raping E. Jean Carroll based on the facts, because there are no facts presented. It is just a claim made by her, a verifiably crazy lady who herself has said that she thinks rape is sexy. And oh, by the way, they changed a law to erase the statute of limitations for a year, just a grace period for whoever wanted to file sexual related lawsuits and hadn't done so in the past. We need to be able to judge all past actions or inactions or made up actions based on our current cultural interpretations of how we should view these things. Basically, there was a Me Too exception. Hey, we have a Me Too exception here. We need to erase the laws and not follow the laws right now because Me Too is so important. We're just going to pay to get this law changed just for 1 year. And as soon as we get it changed, we're going to file a suit by E. Jean Carroll accusing the president of rape. No, she doesn't know when it happened. It was too traumatic to remember. And that's why she jokes about it so much. Mr. Stephanopoulos, who was named as a co-defendant, said Mr. Trump was found liable for rape during a contentious interview on March 10th with Representative Nancy Mace, Republican of South Carolina. During the interview, Mr. Stephanopoulos asked Ms. Mace, who has spoken publicly about being raped as a teenager, why she continued to support Mr. Trump in light of the outcome of the civil case. Mr. Trump, who often galvanizes his supporters by attacking the press, has filed a string of unsuccessful defamation suits against major media organizations. Federal judges have dismissed his suits against CNN, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. ABC News had no comment on Monday. Mr. Trump's suit was filed in federal court in the Southern District of Florida. This article, by the way, written by Jim Rutenberg of The New York Times, who is also the guy who wrote the piece from Monday about how Trump's allies were winning the war over disinformation in advance of the SCOTUS arguments on Missouri versus Biden. The guy is like their propaganda workhorse. Now, a couple of weeks ago, at Amuse on X, formerly Twitter, quote posted an E. Jean Carroll post where she said, "Do you want to vote for the man who has to pay me $83,300,000 because a unanimous federal jury said he lied?" In response, at Amuse wrote, "The jury determined you, Ms. Carroll, lied when you said the president raped you. They didn't find you credible." And they have the verdict form from that case in the Southern District of New York. The first question: did Ms. Carroll prove by a preponderance of evidence that Mr. Trump raped Ms. Carroll. Check mark in the no box. Now, it's worth noting that ABC's George Stephanopoulos, the man who over and over again lied on television and said that Donald Trump had been found liable for raping E. Jean Carroll, is a longtime Democrat hack and Clinton associate. He worked on Bill Clinton's presidential campaign in 1992 and became the Clinton administration White House communications director for Bill Clinton's first term. His Wikipedia entry also includes this item. In 2010, Stephanopoulos attended a dinner party at the home of convicted sex offender socialite Jeffrey Epstein, along with Chelsea Handler, Woody Allen, Katie Couric, Prince Andrew, Charlie Rose, and Eva Anderson Dubin. Following Epstein's arrest in July 2019, the party resurfaced online, with those attending receiving backlash. Stephanopoulos denied being friends with Epstein, with the party being the only encounter. So make of that what you will, but he is falsely accusing Donald Trump of being a rapist on air and saying that is what the courts have decided, that it's somehow now proven to an authoritative source in the eyes of all the commies out there. That is more than enough. It doesn't matter if that will be appealed and overturned. If and when that happens, they won't know about it. If they find out about it, they won't care. Just like we talked about the other day with Trump's incitement to violence over and over again. Sure, every one of the cases is individually proven false, but the fact that there are so many of them makes it seem like they all collectively must have some sort of truth attached to them. Donald Trump just is the guy who treats women so badly, despite the fact that none of these women can prove that he did that. Just like Donald Trump constantly incites violence from his supporters, even though there's no proof of that being true. They always point to the very violent insurrection hoax, but no one even takes that seriously anymore, unless, of course, they are one of those child-brained communists. You had to have simply ignored all of the information for the last 3 years, just focused on that fateful day in January 2021, where you saw on television how bad Trump was, and anything that comes out since then, well, it just doesn't change your opinion. Now let's move to the immunity issue. This is from today, the Columbus Dispatch. Ohio AG Yost suggests test for Supreme Court to determine limits of presidential immunity. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost has weighed in on a U.S. Supreme Court case concerning presidential immunity and former President Donald Trump. Yost filed an amicus brief, a court filing with advice or information related to a particular case from parties with a strong interest in the outcome in Trump versus United States. The brief was filed with attorneys general from Wyoming and Alaska on Tuesday to support Trump's argument that he has presidential immunity from criminal charges related to the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Yost said in a news release Tuesday that the country's founders understood, quote, a president cannot fulfill the oath of office without reasonable immunity from criminal charges, end quote, and added that presidential immunity is broad but not unlimited. Yost suggested a two-part legal test for the court to decide whether to apply presidential immunity. The first consideration would be how closely the acts the president is accused of are to the president's powers under the Constitution. The second consideration would be whether the president needed to take action based on the urgency of the situation. To decide whether a president is immune from a criminal charge under this part of the inquiry, fact-finding will determine whether the situation demanded the president's actions, the attorney general said in the brief. And by this test, Donald Trump would obviously be immune in these various fake indictments, particularly the ones brought by Jack Smith, but those actions cross over into the fake indictment from Fannie Willis down in Fulton County, the RICO case. All of this depends on Donald Trump actually doing something wrong when it comes to challenging the stolen election or the conduct on January 6, 2021. And they're unable to prove any of this stuff, of course, because Donald Trump did exactly what he should have done as the duly elected president of the United States. You can't just allow a global regime and their representatives in the country working with foreign actors to usurp the government of the United States and install a Manchurian candidate. An illegitimate, totally compromised, totally corrupted, demented old pervert named Joe Biden into the presidency. You can't allow that as president. And so Donald Trump took steps to make sure that that couldn't happen, certainly not in a legitimate way. And as for January 6th, he did everything necessary, including authorizing up to 20,000 National Guard troops to guard the Capitol, which was denied by Nancy Pelosi and Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser. Donald Trump's actions were not only in the scope of his official powers and duties, they were what his official powers and duties required. The question, though it is not described this way in the media and with people's common conversations, the question is whether or not the president should have immunity for his official acts. What duty requires? And instead, we've had a comical conversation about whether or not the president could order the military to assassinate his political opponent. You would have to go an awfully long way to figure out how that could be construed as an official act. Now, along those same lines, Politico reporter Kyle Cheney posted this yesterday on X,
formerly Twitter.
Three former military officers, including two who advised Trump, filed a brief with the Supreme Court arguing that even if a president ordered the military to assassinate a rival, the military would refuse to do it. And so let's go through this amicus brief. This is in response to the suggestion that if the Supreme Court sides with Trump on the issue of immunity, that would give Trump the ability to order the assassination of his political opponent. From the brief. Could a president order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival? That question was posed by a member of the panel at oral argument in the court below. Amici Curiae, who have served as military combat generals and senior officials at the Pentagon and have held other senior executive branch positions, submit that the answer to the panel member's question is a resounding no. A president of the United States enjoys broad authority to direct the military with very few limitations. But one such limitation is that the president's orders may not contravene the Constitution or the laws of the United States. Accordingly, the president has no authority to order the military to assassinate a political rival. Furthermore, the military is required not to carry out such an unlawful, non-military order if given. Indeed, any military officer who carried out or issued such an order would be committing the gravest of crimes, murder. Whether or not a president has the immunity claimed by the petitioner in this case, a question Amici do not address in this brief, a president cannot order the military to assassinate a political rival and have that order carried out. Amici Curiae are three former high-ranking military leaders. Their military and Pentagon service spans more than half a century, under 10 presidents of both political parties and widely divergent policy agendas. Amicus Secretary Robert Wilkie served in the Pentagon as Assistant Secretary of Defense under President George W. Bush, then Under Secretary of Defense for Policy, the third highest ranking position in the Pentagon under President Donald Trump. He served in the United States Navy and the United States Air Force Reserves, attaining the rank of colonel. He concluded his public service as a cabinet rank official in the Trump administration, serving as Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. He is currently a Distinguished Fellow for American Security at the America First Policy Institute. Amicus, retired Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg, is a Vietnam veteran who was the commander of the 82nd Airborne Division and served as commander of Special Operations Command Europe. He later served in the Trump administration as executive secretary and chief of staff of the National Security Council in the White House, as national security advisor to the vice president, and as acting national security advisor to the president of the United States. He is currently co-chair of the Center for American Security at the America First Policy Institute. amicus, retired Lieutenant General William Gerald Jerry Boykin, has a distinguished combat career that included the attempted rescue of Americans in the Iranian hostage crisis under President Carter. As a colonel, he was commander of the Army's elite Delta Force and commanded all the Green Berets and the JFK Special Warfare Center, which trains the Green Berets. He also served in the Pentagon in the civilian role of Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence and served a tour with the CIA. He is currently the Executive Vice President of the Family Research Council. And so let's get into their argument. This is the summary. The president has broad authority to issue military orders with some noteworthy limitations. One such limitation is that the president has no authority to order the military to assassinate someone because he is a political rival. Nor would the military carry out such an unlawful order. Under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, any military officer who carried out or issued such an order would commit the crime of murder. In addition, Executive Order 12333 prohibits any person employed by the U.S. government from engaging in or conspiring to engage in assassination. Thus, no military officer has the legal authority to issue or carry out an order requiring murder or assassination. And throughout this discussion, it's worth keeping in mind that Donald Trump himself has seemed to be under threat of assassination. It is certainly a widespread public conversation. There are hints about it in liberal media all the time. Keith Olbermann just the other day was talking about how there was still hope that Donald Trump could be assassinated. So while all of this is directly referencing the immunity arguments that we will be hearing at the Supreme Court in about a month, this principle, this argument may have implications on other issues, especially if Trump assassination talk continues. Who knows? This might have implications about stuff going way back up to and including the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We are still waiting on disclosure about the full extent of what happened there. But back to the brief. Accordingly, the answer to the panel member's question is no. The president cannot order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate his political rival and have the military carry out such an order. So let's go through some of their argument. This is part one. The president's broad power as commander-in-chief does not include the authority to order the military to commit murder. At oral argument in the court below, a panel member posed this question to the petitioner's counsel. Could a president order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival? That's an official act, an order to SEAL Team 6. In response to the question, counsel for petitioners stated that a president, quote, would have to be and would speedily be impeached and convicted before the criminal prosecution, end quote. Numerous media outlets seized on this exchange. Headlines like Trump's lawyer argues that a president can order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate his political rival if Congress is cool with it. That from Yahoo News. Trump's boldest argument yet, immunity from prosecution for assassinations. That, of course, is the old gray lady, the paper of record, the New York Times. The D.C. Circuit's opinion seemingly referred to the exchange, stating that petitioners, quote, proposed interpretation still would leave a president free to commit all manner of crimes with impunity, so long as he is not impeached and convicted. In Amici's view, the panel member's question may be answered with a firm no. To be clear, there may be circumstances in which a president may order the military to use lethal force against particular individuals to protect national security. But no such circumstances were referenced in the panel member's question and therefore are not the subject of this brief or this case. The answer to the question the panel member asked is that a president cannot simply order an elite military unit to kill a political rival. The office of the president of the United States has broad authority when it comes to conducting foreign policy and military affairs. But ordering the military to bring about the death of a political rival for political or personal gain is not one of the prerogatives of the office. Under the British form of government from which the United States won independence, the king can do no wrong. But that is not the American form of government under our Constitution. Under the Constitution, no one in the national government, no one, may deprive another, quote, of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, end quote. And that is citing the U.S. Constitution and the Fifth Amendment. That fundamental guarantee is not repealed by the constitutional provision stating that the president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States. In his influential concurrence in Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company versus Sawyer, Justice Jackson agreed that this clause, quote, undoubtedly puts the nation's armed forces under presidential command, end quote. But he rejected the notion that it provides, quote, support for any presidential action, internal or external, involving use of force, the idea being that it vests power to do anything anywhere that can be done with an army or navy. It, quote, seems obvious from the Constitution and from elementary American history, he wrote, that the, quote, military powers of the commander-in-chief were not to supersede representative government of internal affairs. The president's, quote, command power is not such an absolute as might be implied from that office in a militaristic system, but is subject to limitations consistent with a constitutional republic, end quote. The Constitution gives the president no authority to declare martial law or suspend the Bill of Rights. As this court stated in Ex parte Milligan, martial law destroys every guarantee of the Constitution and effectually renders the, quote, military independent of and superior to the civil power, end quote. The attempt to do which by the King of Great Britain was deemed by our fathers such an offense that they assigned it to the world as one of the causes which impelled them to declare their independence. Civil liberty and this kind of martial law cannot endure together. The antagonism is irreconcilable, and in the conflict, one or the other must perish. In short, the president cannot commandeer SEAL Team 6 into using lethal force against his political rival for personal reasons. 2. Military law and an executive order forbid murder and assassination. Even if a president attempted to order the death of a rival, a, quote, high crime, demanding impeachment and removal if there ever was one, the military would not carry it out. Murder is a crime under military law, and an executive order prohibits assassination. The United States Armed Forces embody cherished American values and principles, respect for innocent life and severely punishing those who take it without justification or excuse, codified in federal law, are basic manifestations of those values and principles. The U.S. military is the most effective fighting force in the world, but with that awesome power comes the solemn duty to use force only when necessary, and the purpose of using deadly force is to protect the lives of the innocent, especially our fellow citizens. Every service member who raises his or her hand to take the oath to serve, especially for officers whose oath is to, quote, support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, regards this principle as a solemn obligation. They talk about how the Uniform Code of Military Justice prohibits murder, and in Section B, beyond the UCMJ's prohibition on murder, there is also a presidential order prohibiting assassination, Executive Order 12333 from December 4th, 1981. Section 2.11 of that executive order, captioned Prohibition on Assassination, provides, no person employed by or acting on behalf of the United States government shall engage in or conspire to engage in assassination. Executive Order 12333 has been in force since it was signed by President Reagan, and it can be repealed or amended only by a subsequent executive order, which would be published in the Federal Register for all the world to see. Now, it's obvious the bearing this has on the Trump immunity proceedings. We can expect to hear the arguments about how the court has given Donald Trump the power to assassinate his political opponents, or that they might give him the power to do that. But they won't, and they can't, because there are multiple prohibitions on him doing that. So he would be doing something that is not an official act, an official duty of his office. He is not doing something that his office is allowed to do or his office should do. He's doing something that would be, in that case, in direct violation of what his office demands he not do. So while this might make for good headlines, and while it might convince standard issue villagers, child brains, and other Trump haters that this is what the case is about, and Trump should be denied immunity on this basis, it doesn't make any sense. But this also makes it very clear that if we start hearing about assassinations since, for instance, this executive order was put in place in 1981, those assassinations or even conspiracies, talks about potentially attempting assassinations, would all be crimes. It's certainly something to keep an eye out for, considering that George Herbert Walker Bush was still in and around government for decades past that point. And then, of course, we've got Sir Drones a lot, Barack Hussein Obama. I like the fact that they are getting all of this out on the record in another context. We will keep this in mind for the future. Part 3, military officers are required not to carry out unlawful orders. Any presidential order to the military to use lethal force without legal justification would be an order calling for the commission of a grave felony crime. And any military officers who knowingly issued or carried out such an unlawful order would themselves be criminally liable. The rules for court-martial are promulgated by the president as commander-in-chief and are a mechanism by which the commander-in-chief implements the Uniform Code of Military Justice. A service member may assert as an affirmative defense to a crime that the service member was carrying out an order, but that defense is only valid if the order is lawful. Skipping just a bit ahead, every service member from the newest private to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff would know or must reasonably know that they may not carry out the unlawful order to murder or assassinate someone, even if the order comes from the commander-in-chief. Part 4. The military would not carry out an order to commit murder. Through rigorous instruction and tragic lessons from history, military officers are trained not to carry out unlawful orders, and they know that they may be held criminally liable if they did carry out such orders. In a televised interview during the presidential campaign of 2016, retired General Michael Hayden, who served as director of the CIA and director of the NSA, was asked what would happen if petitioner, then a candidate for president, ordered the military to kill families of terrorist targets. Hayden: if he were to order that once in government, the American armed forces would refuse to act. This is from an appearance on the Bill Maher show, by the way. Maher asks, what? He says, well, that's quite a statement, sir. Hayden says it's a violation. Maher responds, well, I thought that the whole thing was you have to follow orders. Michael Hayden responds, you cannot. You are not committed. You are not required. In fact, you are required not to follow an unlawful order. That would be in violation of all the international laws of armed conflict. Amici occur with General Hayden's assessment. The military would not carry out a patently unlawful order from the president to kill non-military targets. Indeed, service members are required not to do so. Fortunately, examples of military officers carrying out unlawful orders and murdering civilians are exceedingly rare in modern American history. And jumping down to the conclusion, a president cannot order an elite military unit to kill a political rival, and the members of the military are required not to carry out such an unlawful order. It would be a crime to do so. To the extent that the judgment of the Court of Appeals was based on a contrary understanding, the judgment should be vacated or reversed. Now, all of that is quite interesting. It's certainly good support for Donald Trump's argument in this immunity case, but I also get the sense that we are going to hear about this again in the future, and it is very interesting that they included those comments from Michael Hayden. You got to wonder what sort of exposure that guy has. So it will be interesting to see where the Supreme Court goes on this immunity issue. But regardless of how they decide the issue, the facts underlying these fake indictments simply do not support the case that Jack Smith and Fani Willis and others are attempting to make. The election was stolen. evidence continues to pour out, and some of these efforts kind of seem to be converging around a certain timeline. Mike Lindell's case just came out. We'll see how the Supreme Court handles that. And then we have this. This is the Detroit News on Monday. 2,000 pages of confidential Dominion emails dumped on social media. A new social media account using the name and photo of Barry County Sheriff Dar Leaf has released more than 2,100 pages of emails from employees of Dominion Voting Systems as the company maintained Leaf got improper access to internal messages through the breach of a court order. An account on the website X, formerly Twitter, with the handle Sheriff Leaf, sent out links to the Dominion emails, which were marked confidential. Leaf didn't immediately respond Monday to a request from the Detroit News asking whether he was personally operating the account. However, for years, Leaf has investigated the 2020 presidential election and worked with Stephanie Lambert, a Michigan lawyer who's now representing Patrick Byrne, former chief executive officer of Overstock. Dominion, whose election equipment is used in most Michigan counties, is suing Byrne in federal court for defamation after he spread conspiracy theories about Dominion's technology. Lambert, who's facing a bench warrant from Oakland County Circuit Court, appeared in federal court on Monday afternoon in Washington, D.C., where Magistrate Judge Muxila Upadhyaya. Muxila Upadhyaya. Muxila Upadhyaya. Okay. Questioned why she provided the documents to Leaf rather than ask the court to unseal them first. Lambert said she wanted law enforcement to investigate them. If I had a literally dead body, the attorney said, I wouldn't bring it to the court first and ask the court what to do with it. And that is obviously the most sensible thing in the world. You don't take evidence of crimes to courts, you take them to law enforcement. The sheriff would seem like a very logical choice. The U.S. Marshals Service arrested Lambert on the bench warrant Monday, a spokesman confirmed to the New York Times. Skipping down, Lambert has been charged with four felonies for allegedly participating in a conspiracy to obtain and analyze voting equipment that was used in Michigan's 2020 presidential election. Lambert is also facing a bench warrant for her arrest after not showing up for a court hearing in Oakland County on March 7th. Now, this seems like a pretty obvious case of the commies going hard after people trying to expose the fact that our elections are stolen and that Michigan has some of the worst elections in the entire country. Dominion, of course, is claiming that their lives are all being threatened by claims of election fraud, and for that reason, everybody must be silenced. But Dar Leaf doesn't seem like a very silenceable guy, and as he put out all of these documents to the public, he also wrote a letter to Congressman Jim Jordan on Sunday. Here is that letter. My office is investigating criminal acts related to elections in Barry County, the state of Michigan, and the United States. I am in possession of evidence involving voting machines. Additionally, I have recently received a subpoena from Prosecutor D.J. Hilson of Muskegon County for my file. D.J. Hilson worked with the Michigan Attorney General to bury the Muskegon fraud investigation that was initially reported by the Muskegon local clerk. Not one person was charged related to the Muskegon fraud, despite confessions and physical evidence. Considering this, I am going to provide portions of my file to Congress for immediate review and investigation. My office has come into possession of evidence that foreign nationals have accessed electronic voting machines in Michigan and other states. This evidence demonstrates that electronic voting machines and electronic election systems used for elections in Michigan and throughout the United States are not secure, and an immediate investigation is needed by Congress. I have evidence in my file of Serbian foreign nationals entering our election system while the votes were being counted and prior to certification. The election vendor, Dominion, hired these Serbian employees and disclosed in emails that they are not able to provide backgrounds on these individuals due to law in Serbia. It has only been a mere 25 years since conflict involving Serbia. Therefore, the United States has allowed a scenario where potentially Serbian military criminals are running our elections and remotely entering our election equipment. I am investigating the role that some individuals inside the United States have played in conspiring with these foreign nationals, and who have even directed and instructed them to access and interfere with electronic voting machines and electronic voting systems during past elections, including the November 2020 election. Multiple false assurances from state and federal agencies and private companies that our elections were secure and not compromised through remote network access or otherwise. Moreover, I have evidence that U.S. Dominion and its affiliates, Dominion, instructed its employees to alter or otherwise falsify the integrity of the software and hardware in its voting machines and systems to attain certification by the EAC, that's the Election Assistance Commission, even when they knew that the systems could not be properly verified and certified. Additionally, I have evidence that the voting machines and systems are vulnerable to alteration and manipulation, i.e. interference by the use of thumb drives and external devices that can be surreptitiously connected to voting machines before, during, and after elections. And all of this, he's saying he has evidence for, but all of this aligns completely with what J. Alex Halderman filed in his report about how easy it was to access and manipulate these systems. He did it live in court with a pen. But back to Dar Leaf. As a result of this information, my office is also investigating conspiracy crimes, wire services fraud, honest services fraud, and perjury charges, among other criminal acts. The perjury charges stem from assurances by Dominion CEO during sworn testimony before the Michigan legislature that its voting machines and voting systems could not be accessed or connected to by outside networks and sources, and that it was a U.S.-based company. And some of you, hopefully all of you, but I doubt it, some of you certainly remember John Poulos, the Dominion CEO, giving his testimony before the Michigan legislature in that period between the stolen election on November 3rd, 2020, and the illegitimate and fraudulent certification of electors on January 6th. Back to Dar Leaf. As I now have evidence that our election equipment is not secure, and because election voting machines prevent transparency, and vendors have more oversight and authority to have them examined than the officials that are charged with the constitutional duty to ensure our elections are secure, transparent, and fulfill our promise to each and every American that their votes will count and be properly tabulated and not diluted, deleted, or otherwise altered, I am presenting you with this letter and an initial tranche of this evidence so that you will review it and be compelled to investigate this matter and call those responsible for this breach of our Constitution to give testimony concerning these criminal acts and breach of our national security. These matters impact not only us here in the state of Michigan, but every citizen voter in the country who relies on the Constitution's promise that each legal registered citizen voter should have one vote, and that vote should correctly reflect his or her will and choice. As a constitutional officer, my duties are defined by my oath of office, the Constitution, the statutes governing my office, and those powers at common law that were recognized as being attached to my position. In light of this evidence, I am suggesting that every election official consider an emergency backup plan for upcoming elections, to prepare to verify all ballots and voters, and to hand count actual paper ballots at the end of elections to confirm the accuracy of the vote, the voters, and that our election machines are working properly. There is no harm in confirming results to ensure that the will of the people is reflected. And that is very interesting, because this is kind of a semi-official, sort of official statement about what should be done to preserve the sanctity of our upcoming elections. And we have seen templates for this in elections around the world. He is making a recommendation that election officials around the country prepare a plan B. Be ready for the possibility that you may not be able to run your elections with these election fraud machines. Now, people have theorized, speculated that there might be some power outage, problems with the grid, problems with the internet, communications problems, whatever it might be that might prevent an election from being held on November 5th, 2020. Perhaps the illegitimate Biden administration, the Uniparty, the global regime might realize that Donald Trump is a sure thing and they might try to find a way to cancel or postpone the elections. Perhaps we will see the fake president attempt to turn the military forces on American men and women, as he did with various law enforcement agencies. We don't know how any of that is going to go, but election officials should be prepared to hold an election with hand-counted paper ballots. It would be very interesting if that whole system was built up in various places all around the country so that certain locations were ready to go. And then in the event of problems, you'd have to imagine that those that didn't make these preparations would be unable to hold their elections. And that would be a major travesty. That would blow up all of their narratives about the machines, about what actually constitutes a paper ballot. And it would be a major reveal to people about how our elections actually work. We think they're just counting 1 + 1 + 1 + 1. And we have a machine that does that really, really fast because there's just too many voters in the country to actually count all these ballots without a machine. Of course, that makes no sense because with the machines, they still end up carrying out their elections for days or weeks or months. California still doesn't have its totals from the primary a couple of weeks ago. I'm interested to see how this develops. You would hope that there would be some America First election officials around the country who would try to create a system so that they could still hold an election even without the election fraud machines. You can imagine that depending on timing, if the machines were outlawed, the immediate excuse from all corners of the Uniparty would be that we can't have an election now because our entire system has been taken away, which would allow them to delay. If a system had already been built up to account for that eventuality, well, hey, maybe we'll be treated to a legitimate election after all. And let's finish up with Dar Leaf's letter. Thank you in advance for your prompt attention to this matter. Please do not hesitate to contact me if you have any questions or would like additional information concerning my investigation. As it stands, I have no faith in the federal institutions that allowed this garbage in the first place. Therefore, I am attaching unredacted documents for your review. More importantly, for review by the American people. This should allow for Congress to issue subpoenas in an expedited fashion. I look forward to Congress working for the American people and quickly addressing these election security problems while I pursue the criminal investigation with sheriffs across the country. Zero Hedge covered all of this yesterday. Evidence of foreign nationals accessing Dominion voting machines leaked to public. And from that article, the evidence includes emails between Dominion workers about voting machines being accessed remotely from people in Kosovo and elsewhere. And they have some of these examples in the article. It wasn't clear whether the emails were authentic at first, but Dominion apparently confirmed the evidence when it notified the presiding judge about the leak in a filing on Friday. The attorney who leaked the evidence, Stephanie Lambert, has also now been arrested over the matter. According to Dominion, Byrne gave a trove of confidential discovery material to his attorney, Lambert, who then leaked it to law enforcement and others. But Lambert's misconduct does not end there, Dominion added. Not only did Lambert follow her client's instruction to share Dominion's documents with an unknown number of individuals, she also filed dozens of them publicly in an unrelated proceeding to which Dominion is not a party, and they have now been viewed by tens of thousands of users on social media. Gosh, that is so sad. According to Dominion, the evidence leaked doesn't show any criminality. Dominion blasted, quote, "Lambert's xenophobic conclusion is that any email from non-US based Dominion personnel is conclusive evidence of criminal activity, end quote. So yeah, that's it. It's because it's foreigners that it's a crime. That's what everybody is so freaked out about. Far from running from Dominion's allegations, Byrne and Lambert have both admitted to leaking the discovery materials. They said the materials contain evidence of criminality, meaning that they're not protected by any protective order. So they can't get in trouble for leaking evidence of criminality. That's the argument. In a response to Dominion filed Monday, Lambert defended her actions. Mr. Byrne came into possession of email communications produced by Dominion during discovery, some written in Serbian and foreign languages, with and from top-level Dominion employees directing and tasking foreign nationals to remotely access voting machines utilized in the United States during the November 3rd, 2020 election. That doesn't sound like xenophobia to me. The remote access by these foreign nationals occurred while the states were still counting votes, determining a final tally, and prior to certification of the results. The email communications further established that background checks of the Serbian Dominion employees did not take place. The United States had no knowledge or oversight of these Serbian individuals, including whether or not they had prior Serbian military experience. So we have a couple thousand Dominion emails proving involvement via Dominion by foreigners in our elections. That sounds like foreign interference in an American election. And if that is proven, which it does seem to be, well, that would cause Executive Order 13848 to spring into effect. Now, has it done that? We've been told that it has. It doesn't seem like we've seen the results, but we may have. In the future, we might look back, reframing things, understanding, oh yeah, that event was a result of the enforcement of Executive Order 13848. And you have to wonder how far the involvement will go from there. How many people, how many organizations, how many countries took part in foreign interference in an American election? It's going to be a lot. I can't wait to find out. And I know people are frustrated because all of this is just injustice with no solution we can really grasp onto. That's incredibly frustrating. And it's a bit scary to live in a country where this sort of thing happens all the time with no recourse. Tens of millions of people, more than 100 million people very likely, can understand this to be true and have no recourse. And the media and the corporations, the government, the political parties, the universities, everybody just gaslights the public. The American men and women are constantly told that all of this evidence is false. None of it constitutes actual evidence. All of this is a conspiracy theory. Despite the fact that the majority of the country knows it's not true, they don't stop saying it because, again, to them, until the information, until the claim is approved by authoritative sources and incorporated into the central narrative, it's just not real. I'll be back tomorrow at the same reasonable time on the same reasonable podcast network. I don't have a network. Masks and lockdowns don't work. They lied to you about a pandemic, and Joe Biden will never be president.
In my mind, that's the end game.
If you're listening to this episode for free, you can support me and support the show and the work I do by signing up for a paid subscription at imyourmoderator.substack.com. You can do so for as low as $50 a year or $5 a month. Comes out to under a quarter per episode, and you'll blast right through the paywall for all of the writing. The merch store is www.cancelcouture.com, and you can find everything else by heading to Linktree, linktree.com/imyourmoderator. And I'll see you soon, out on the range.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
In my mind, that's the end game.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to follow what I'm reading and thinking throughout the day, you can do that by downloading the Telegram Messenger app and going to t.me/I'm Your Moderator. On social media, you can follow me on Truth Social, Getter, and Gab at I'm Your Moderator. I also have channels on Rumble and BitChute. If you'd like to follow the writing, you can find me at imyourmoderator.substack.com. The merch site is cancelcouture.com or go direct shop.spreadshirt.com/cancel-couture. If you'd like to support the podcast financially, the best place to do that is Ko-Fi. Go to ko-fi.com/imyourmoderator. And all of these details will appear in the show notes with each episode. I'll see you soon, down on the range.
It's happening!